Years ago, the writer of Psalm 119 said, "Therefore I esteem right all your precepts concerning everything." In the same psalm, it's the sum of your word is truth, and every one of your righteous ordinances is everlasting. And then Jesus said in John 17:17, "Sanctify them in the truth. Thy word is truth." Near the end, and we looked at this Wednesday night, near the end of the kingdom of Judah, the last king of Judah, Zedekiah, brought in Jeremiah privately and took him aside and asked him, "Is there a word from the Lord? Is there a word from God?" And Jeremiah said, "There is." And the word was the same word that Jeremiah had been consistently preaching all these years. That God was giving the rebellious kingdom of Judah, because they did not repent, into the hand of the Babylonians. And that's Jeremiah 38, verse 17. Jeremiah then says to the king, "Where are your prophets who said, who prophesied to you, saying the king of Babylon will not come against you or against this land? Where are they now?" And I think Jeremiah was saying, in other words, where are all the people that you've been listening to instead of God? Where are all these people that you trusted and you thought they had the answer? Where are all your experts who said, this is not going to happen and it's happening? Because they were all wrong. I want to kind of look at that tonight. I want to look at some things that people said about the Bible or against the Bible. And then what happened? One of the things that people said years ago is that Moses could not have written the law of Moses. Moses cannot be the author of that. Now, the Bible clearly tells us that Moses wrote the law. In fact, in the book of Matthew chapter 8 and verse 4, when Jesus heals an individual or some individuals, after that Jesus says, "See that no, you tell no one, but go show yourself to the priest to present the offering that Moses commanded." And he's citing an offering in the law. In Matthew chapter 19 and verse 8, when the Pharisees or scribes said to Jesus, "Why then did Moses command us to give, you know, your wife her certificate of divorce and put her away?" It's interesting that Jesus did not say, "Well, Moses didn't write that. Don't you know any better? Moses is not the author of the book of Deuteronomy." Jesus agreed that Moses was the author of Deuteronomy chapter 24. Because he says, "Moses did this because," or "Moses wrote this because." In the book of Matthew chapter 22, verse 24, the Sadducees will say to Jesus, "Teacher, Moses said, if a man dies having no children, his brother and next of kin shall marry his wife and raise up children for his brother." And that is found in the law. And Jesus does not say, "Moses didn't write that. Someone else wrote that." Jesus does not dispute the point that Moses did write that. But what men said was that writing did not exist in the time of Moses. It's too early for writing. That the Israelites could neither read nor write. They were an illiterate people. That was the argument that was made. And that the laws in the Old Testament, in the law, Genesis through Deuteronomy, and primarily Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, are too advanced for the time in which Moses lived. And so they were written by someone else later on. Brendan ran into this at Portland State. It's called the documentary hypothesis. And it's the idea that you have different unnamed writers who write parts of the Old Testament and not the writers attached to the books. And all the books are written far later than what the Bible says. But that whole theory rested upon the idea that writing could not exist in the time of Moses. And the problem with that theory is it was massively disproven. You know, there's a 1953 movie, and it's not the version, obviously, that was done, I think, in 2005, War of the Worlds with Tom Cruise. I like it much better. And so you have these, what look like meteors that come and hit the Earth, and out of these, what looks like a meteor comes these spaceships. And, you know, you have tanks and machine guns and things like that that try to stop them, and that's not stopping them. And so finally they reach this point that they're going to bring in the flying wing. And since this is after World War II, this movie comes out, they're going to drop the atomic bomb on these spaceships. And they're all kind of in a pod, I think, outside of Los Angeles and haven't moved yet. They bring in the flying wing and they drop an atomic bomb, and they have some forward observers, guys like in this observation post with sandbags, and there's all this wind and dust flying after the blast. And they're being radioed like, you see anything? Do you see anything? Do you see anything? Do you see anything? And for a while they don't see anything. It's just dust and debris. And then those spaceships start coming through there. And they said they're coming through and there's not a scratch on them. And may I suggest to you that that's kind of the way it's been biblically with some of these accusations against the Bible. The Bible takes a hit. It's accused of something. And then there's an uproar, and then the dust settles, and we're wondering, is the Bible still going to make it through the dust? Is it still intact as the Word of God? And the dust has settled. In 1901 and 1902, the Code of Hammurabi was discovered in what was Persia, but now Iran. And that code was written several hundred years before the time of Moses. The time of Moses is like 1500, 1400 B.C., and this code is like 2000 to 1700 B.C., and it's written, and it's a code of very advanced moral and civil laws. In fact, the code probably reflects God's laws prior to Law Moses, that is, what God had said to people like Adam and Noah and Seth and Abraham, that it reflects a very high level of morality among ancient people. And many of the laws are similar to what would be found in the Law of Moses. The next claim is that the Bible mentions the Hittites. And it doesn't just mention them once. They're mentioned in Genesis chapter 15, verse 20, about the land that God would give the descendants of Abraham, and it included the territory that had belonged to the Hittites, as well as the Jebusites, the Canaanites, and other tribes. It actually mentions the Hittites 440 times in the Old Testament. The thing is, though, that for a long time, no other document from the ancient world had mentioned the Hittites. The Bible was the only document that mentioned them. It was the only source that had mentioned them for quite a while. And therefore, skeptics of the Bible said, we're dealing with a mythical people. The Bible is having us believe that the nation of Israel and other nations had battles against this mythical people. And the dust has settled. The reality is that they did exist. And they were a very powerful people. In fact, in the book of 2 Kings chapter 7, it's interesting. This is in the time of Elisha. And in the time of Elisha, there's a situation where God causes the Syrian army to think that an army is approaching. And it says in verse 6 of 2 Kings 7, the Lord had caused the army of the Syrians to hear a sound of chariots and a sound of horses, even the sound of a great army, so that they said to one another, behold, the king of Israel has hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the kings of the Egyptians to come upon us. That is, they were a people that other nations feared. And so the Syrians skedaddle, because they think the Hittites are on the way, along with, like, the Egyptians. Their capital city was discovered, which is now in modern Turkey. A library that contained 10,000 tablets was also discovered. And it's now known that the Hittite people were an incredibly powerful people of the time, and you can actually get a degree in, like, Hittite history, a college degree. That's how important they were in the ancient world. Yet, up to a certain point in time, like around 200 years ago, the Bible was the only document from the ancient world that mentioned them. Nobody else. No other ancient historian mentioned those people. The Bible was the only document. In Isaiah chapter 20 and verse 1 is the only reference to Sargon, king of Assyria, and I believe not only the only reference in secular history, but also biblical history. The sole reference to a king named Sargon, king of Assyria. And many critics accuse the Bible of having been inaccurate at the point, because up to a certain time on the kings of Assyria, no other ancient writer had mentioned this king. And people are saying, Bible made it up. Bible writers made it up. They're talking about some sort of mythical person. The dust has settled. In 1843, Sargon's palace was unearthed. And yes, he was the king of the Assyrians. And in fact, now you can go online and you can see like what Sargon's name looks like in Assyrian. You can see his palace, all of that. Yes, he was a king of Assyria. Here's an interesting one. And I was talking to some ladies the other day at a garage sale. And I looked at them. I was kind of looking at them. I was listening to them. And I said, "You're Persian, aren't you?" And they said, "Yes, we're Persian." And I said, "I was just reading about Cyrus, king of Persia." And they said, "My daughter did a historical report on Cyrus, king of Persia in school. It was like great conquerors. And who are we going to choose for Persian? We've got to choose Cyrus, king of the Medo-Persian Empire." And I thought, well, that's absolutely great. So she got dressed up where she kind of looked like Cyrus, or what Cyrus might have looked like on different tablets. And you would interact with her at school. You would push a button, here would be your question. And then she would like go into character and act like Cyrus or give you some historical information. The thing is, though, Cyrus takes Babylon. And in Daniel chapter 5, Belshazzar is mentioned as the king of Babylon. And here's the big problem. The problem is that, here's one more example, is, but no other historical document mentioned a king of named Belshazzar. It is that all the documents were very clear. All the critics said the Bible's wrong because all the historical sources that we had said Nabonidus was the last king of Babylon, and he did not die. He was captured by the Persians. He was not put to death in like the battle. And so the Bible's wrong. The Bible's wrong. In the book of Daniel chapter 5, though, here's one of those places where embedded in the text is a clue. Or the answer. In Daniel chapter 5, remember that Belshazzar has taken all the vessels out of the Lord's house that have been captured, and they have wine in them, and they're all drinking. They're having a drinking party. And all of a sudden, a hand starts writing on the wall. And no one knew what it meant, what was written on the wall. And so he's like, and he is getting desperate, and he calls all his conjurers and Chaldeans and diviners. And he said in Daniel 5:7, "Any man who could read this inscription and explain its interpretation to me shall be clothed with purple and shall have a necklace of gold around his neck and have authority over a third ruler in a kingdom." And it's very easy to read through that and go to the next verse and not catch third ruler. Well, that's interesting. Why not second ruler? Why is he offering third place and not second place? There's your clue. And the answer was found on, and there's more than one of these. These are like There's Cyrus cylinders that look like this that basically have the same information as Ezra 1, 1 through 4. It's the same information. This is the Nabonidus, one of his cylinders. And on this cylinder, in 1854, when it's discovered, it mentions Belshazzar as his eldest son and that he had been appointed co-regent. That's why Belshazzar's called king, and that's why he says anyone who can interpret the handwriting on the wall will be the third ruler of the kingdom, because he cannot give you second place because he's in second place. He's actually the second ruler of the kingdom. His dad had left. His dad goes out into the desert for like 10 years on some sort of quest, and his dad leaves him in charge of Babylon. In fact, he's a real person. He's the king's son. He was made co-regent while his father stayed in Arabia. And here's an actual inscription from what one of the cylinders says. Nabonidus entrusted the army to his oldest son, his firstborn. The troops in the country ordered under his command. He let everything go, entrusted the kingship to him, and he himself started out on a long journey. And the Bible's right. He is technically the last king of Babylon. That is, he is the king that's there when it falls, because Nabonidus is not there. He's out on some quest. Here's another one. You would think that, well, there has to be like a whole lot of references outside the Bible to the reality of King David. But there are not. In fact, when I was born, there were zero. The only book from the ancient world that talked about King David was the Bible. No other historian, no other reference, no other tablet, no other inscription mentioned David. And so people got to the point and thought, maybe King David is somewhat of a mythical person. Some sort of idealized king that the Israelites kind of come up in their imagination. Maybe he's someone that never really existed. Again, the Bible was the only document from the ancient world that mentioned the historical existence of King David. And the dust has settled. And it didn't settle long. It was 1993 that it settled. Now, for Christians, it had settled long ago. But in 1993, as they're doing excavations up north, what is called Tel Dan, they found, and this is would be like, and I've been there years ago, but this is kind of what it looks like, part of it. It's also the place where you can see the platform where Jeroboam set up one of the golden calves. That platform has been unearthed. And they found this. And on that, it's a document written by one of the king, the Syrian kings. And the Syrian king says, I defeated this person, and I defeated this person, and a number of these are Bible names, and I defeated this person of the house of David. And the dust settled. David was a real historical person. Because this king on a document says, I defeated this king, and those kings are of the house of David, or of David's lineage, David's line. David was a real historical person. Of course, as Christians, we knew that already anyway. So, summation. One example after another, that is summation of at least this part. The Bible was the only document that mentioned a person, a people, etc. It was attacked. It's wrong. It's mythical. It's inaccurate. We have a big blow up. We have a big bomb goes off. We're in that forward post with the goggles. Is anything coming through? And here comes the Bible through. Intact, historically accurate, proven true once more. All right. Even when, for a while, it was the lone voice. It was the only document that said this is true, and nobody said that. Nobody backed it up. It just stood there by itself, saying that's true. And then, as the centuries go by, information comes in, etc. Other documents come in, inscriptions come in, and we go like, well, it is true. It is true. But it was the lone voice for a long time. It just stood there by itself saying that's true. Okay. Bible says that sex outside of marriage is wrong. Bible calls it fornication. Some of your translations have the word immorality, but often that is fornication, which is a broad category that would include adultery. It would include homosexuality, but it also includes sex prior to marriage, like living together relationships, cohabitation. In the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and in verse 1, it says, "Now concerning things about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to touch a woman, but because that is, it's okay to live a celibate life. You don't have to marry." That was one of their questions. But because of immoralities, because most people are not cut out for the celibate life, most people are not cut out for a life of singleness, it says, because of immoralities, each man is to have his own wife. That is, if I'm a man and I'm with a woman and she's not my wife, that's immorality. That's fornication. In fact, in chapter 6, it says, flee fornication or flee immorality. And it's also one of the works of the flesh in Galatians chapter 5, 19. Then if you practice it, you don't make it to heaven. All right, Bible said that. Still does today. The world had said, though, there's a certain point that we've reached in our culture that the world said the Bible's wrong on that. We don't agree with that. And that living together prior to marriage actually is a really good idea. Because what it will do, it will ensure better marriages. Because you're not going to end up marrying someone that is not compatible to your needs or your preferences. That if you live with them, you can. It's kind of a trial sort of thing, like you test drive a car or something like that. You live with them, you say, okay, are we incompatible in all these areas? Right? And so I can kind of weed out the people that are not I'm not compatible with, and I find the person I am. And if people do that, that will lower divorces, because you're not going to end up marrying someone that is a big surprise. That, wait a minute, we're not compatible. Now, that sounds pretty good. As far as human wisdom is concerned, that sounds pretty good. The dust has settled on that. I think after probably 50 years now of running that experiment, the dust has pretty much settled. And here's what we know. People that live together prior to marriage have a higher divorce rate than those who do not. And a lot of people are going like, well, how can that be? It just makes sense. It just makes sense, though, if people live together, that obviously they're not going to marry someone they're not compatible with. How is it that it just... Other people say, well, that just doesn't make any sense. But surveys show that there's a negative cohabitation effect. Couples who live together before marriage tend to be less satisfied with their marriages and more likely to divorce than couples who do not. And that's from the New York Times. You see, living together is involvement, but marriage is commitment. Kind of like the old story about the chicken and the pig that both were going to contribute for breakfast. And the chicken said, you know, I'll give it the eggs and you give the bacon or the ham. And the pig says, well, you know, you giving the eggs, that's involvement. But me giving the ham, that's total commitment. That there is a difference. Between, not only that, but here's what also has been found. Studies at the University of Michigan point out that men and women do not view living together the same way. Women tend to view living together as a step before marriage to that person they're living with. That the living together is part of the movement towards marriage, that the living together is part of the commitment. We're moving in that direction. Men see living together as something they do before making any sort of commitment. Surprise, surprise. The two sexes do not view it the same way. They view it differently. One is, well, you know, I'm planning on marrying you. And the other is, you're a nice stop before I find the person I want to marry. They're kind of two completely different things. Also, I think most people know that living together does not prepare you for marriage. I mean, it might prepare you for how to do laundry and do a meal and etc. and how to clean a toilet and make a bed. But it doesn't prepare you for marriage because it's not marriage. And people know it's not marriage. That's why they do it. How many people do you know that they're with a man who refuses to commit? And so they're in this kind of like, well, I'd like to get married, but he's... I mean, I've known all sorts of people that they realize it is not the same thing as marriage. All right, here's another one. The Bible says that there is only one cause for divorce with the right of remarriage. And passages like Matthew chapter 19 would be one passage, verse 9. I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for immorality, that is immorality on her part, and the immorality there is sexual immorality, that is she has cheated on you, and marries another woman, commits adultery, take out the exception clause and what that is. You divorce a woman who has not cheated on you, and you marry another woman, and you're in adultery. Okay. Now, we know how that has gone over. I don't agree with that. We know that the world looks at that passage and says, well, I don't agree with that. I mean, the world says, well, the Bible's wrong there, because I can think of many scenarios where divorce with the right of remarriage should be allowed. I can think of all sorts of scenarios, the world says. Not only that, but about 40 years ago, early 70s, late 60s, our culture started saying, because it used to be that in order to get a divorce, there had to be fault on the person that you were wanting to divorce. They must have done something wrong. They're an unfit mother. You know, you watch the old Perry Mason episodes. They're not, you know what it is. I mean, they're trying to get some dirt on the other person, that there had to be fault that was proven before you could divorce. And people said, you know, why don't we just get rid of that? Why don't we come up with a no-fault divorce? Because that would make everything better. Number one, it would make things better for the couple. They're clearly unhappy. Just let them get divorced and they will both find someone they're more compatible with. And they will both be now happy campers now. Because right now, they don't like each other. Number two, the children that are hearing mom and dad argue, if mom and dad would just get divorced and find someone they're happy with, then the children will be happier. That was kind of the argument that was, and everyone would just be happier all around. And then the other argument will be, it's better for women. Because some of the early feminists made the argument that marriage is a male-dominated, patriarchal, outdated relationship, and that one called it a comfortable concentration camp. That's what marriage is, a comfortable concentration camp. And if we just allow women where, hey, you don't have to prove it anything. You can, if you want out, you can get out, and you can be free. So that was, and you know what? From human wisdom, that sounds pretty good. Just let people go their way and they'll find somebody and they'll be happier. And we'll be happier. And the dust has settled. I mean, that was like 40 years ago. And here what we found, it was like an oops. It was, there's these, all these unintended consequences we hadn't thought about. We didn't see that. And in fact, one of the writers who said that marriage is a comfortable concentration camp later said, I think we made a mistake with no-fault divorce. Because here's what we discovered. That God had saw this coming, but we did not. Number one, it's not good for women. During fault divorce, where someone actually had to be at fault, he's cheated on me, whatever. In those cases, in 82% of the time, women got the family home when it was fault divorce. The woman got the home. In no fault divorce, women get the home only 37% of the time. The home's a big asset. It's also a place to live. And it might be paid for, or significantly paid for. University of Michigan found that divorced women are more likely than men to lose their health insurance after a divorce and to live in poverty more generally, with 22% of post-divorce women falling into poverty versus 11% of men. Also, it was not good for the kids. Here's what we know. Divorce, and this does not mean if like your mom and dad got divorced that you cannot survive. But what it means is it doesn't help. And what it means is there's a number of kids that don't survive, that don't do very well. You can come out of that situation and be a whole person. You can come out of that situation. But what it just says is there's a whole lot of kids that don't come out whole people. And that is that they're worse off emotionally, economically, in addition to raising the odds that children from broken homes will break up their own homes as adults, fall into crime, drugs, become a teen mom, get sick, pick up smoking, have a stroke, die young, etc. Is there's a lot of things that our culture did not anticipate would happen. It's also not good for men. Now, this was an interesting thing. I read a statistic that most divorces are initiated by women. And I didn't realize that. That it's not just men that, hey, I'm in love with the secretary at the office now, and I'm going to go to Mexico and get a divorce or whatever. That's what the old Perry Mason Warren episodes often are. It's not that way. It's a lot of divorces are initiated by women. And here's the thing is for men. You're a man, and you didn't do anything wrong. You didn't cheat on her. You haven't abused her. You've been a good husband, okay? You haven't done anything wrong. You want to stay in the marriage. You want the marriage to remain intact. And she says, I want out. But you didn't cheat. I mean, you're not a drug addict or, you know what I mean? I mean, you haven't done anything wrong. And too bad, now you have to support two households. I got a neighbor up the street like that. He got married, had a couple kids. The wife says, I'm tired of you, didn't cheat. He's living with his dad because he cannot afford to pay alimony and child support and live on his own. He didn't do anything wrong. That kind of stinks. And I like what one feminist said. No man should ever be deprived of the right to see his children solely because the woman wants to leave and the man has done nothing wrong. And no man should have to support a woman who abandons him when he's not at fault. And I like what she said. She said, hey, women, we're all about empowerment and equal rights and etc. What's equal about? He hasn't cheated on me, and I'm just kind of like, I'd like to try somebody else out. But I want him to pay for my lifestyle. I mean, there's nothing equal about that. She said, what if men started treating us that way? You wouldn't like it. And so I thought there's a pretty good point that it's not good for men either. Well, the Bible was right, had the right answers all along, even during times when most did not agree with it. The majority did not agree with it. So what do you think? When the dust settles, and it always does, what are the chances that the Bible will be equally proven right when it comes to the definition of marriage? We've been running a little social experiment in this country on that, as other countries have. Kids with two moms and two dads, how do you think that's going to go? Do you think the dad is going to support that or say, that was not the best idea? Or homosexual behavior, we've been running an experiment on that one. Or gender issues, or the transgender movement. And all these other things, the Bible has come out after the dust settled. It was right, it was right, it was right, it was right. And even on a number of social issues that a lot of data has come in, it's right, it's right, it's right, it's right. I think it's going to be right on that too. There may be one here tonight who's not a Christian. Years ago, I had the impression that, I mean, you just got to believe. Cross your fingers, you just have to believe. And that's not the case. You don't have to just cross your fingers. Don't be baptized unless you truly believe that Jesus is the Christ. Don't become a Christian if you truly, and the way to truly believe that is pick up the Bible, pick it up, examine all the evidence. If you got any questions, ask another question about it. Ask myself. But the Bible's got nothing to hide. Let's pull it all out. Let's take a look at everything. What about this? What about that? Etc. I guess the thing that I think a lot of us Christians are, we're not uncomfortable where people say, I want to examine the Bible. We relish that. We wish that people would ask us that every day at work. Hey, I'm coming over to your house tonight, and we're going to look at the Bible. I would love that every night. How about you? I would love people to say that to me. I got some questions. I want to examine it and put it under the microscope. Let's go. I got all the time in the world for that. I think the thing that at times bothers us is that people don't want to talk about it. And people that don't want to talk about these issues. I was talking to some people. All the Supreme Court stuff on the man being appointed was coming up. And I'm trying to be impartial. You know, I feel for her. But I don't want to condemn an innocent man if he's innocent. You know, without proof and evidence and definite things. But here's something I wish that someone would say on that panel. It looks like that us Democrats and Republicans both agree on one thing. That if a man forces himself sexually upon a woman, that's wrong. It looks like that we both agree on that. Okay, my next question is, why do we think it's wrong? I would love for someone to say, why do we think it's wrong? Because it looks like we think it's absolutely wrong. Because we're talking about something 30, 40 years ago. But we believe it's wrong. And it was wrong back then, and it's wrong now, so that sounds to me, and not only that, but it's wrong no matter who does it. So it looks like we're talking about something is wrong in all places, all times, and for all people. That sounds like that we're talking about an absolute truth. And my question for you is, I don't think we can have an absolute truth and we're all admitting we're talking about one. Because we both agree it's wrong. I don't think you can have an absolute truth without a lawgiver. A creator. So, are we all saying there is a God and certain things are wrong, no matter who you are, no matter when it is, no matter where you live? Is that what we're all saying? To me, that's the elephant in the room that I wish someone would point out to everyone. Right? Everyone's saying it's wrong. So let's just admit it can only be wrong in a universe where there is a God. Because if there is no lawgiver, there's no law. And it's just your opinion and my opinion. And it doesn't matter. To me, that's today's reason. As a society, we do admit from time to time, there is a God. And there is right and wrong. And there is absolute truth. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. Let's be standing and singing the invitation song.